The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So I want to share with you some of my reflections from this weekend. And you'll permit me not to give a Dharma talk, but maybe a Dharma chat, since maybe they're not so well formulated. But the topic is an important one, and one that is, I think, seldom talked about. And maybe even there's some reluctance to teach it here in the United States, because the topic is easily something that is off-putting for people, or can it come across as something which is maybe even dangerous. And that is the topic of strength, that developing inner strength and inner power even through this practice of ours, that is part of what we're doing here in this practice. And I think much of the way that the insight meditation practice is taught in the modern West, maybe that's implicit, but it's explicitly more language of acceptance, more language of just being with your experience, not trying to fix your experience. The idea of personal agency, that you have some control, some power, some in your practice, is not doesn't really get emphasized. And I think that sometimes maybe it's a shortcoming that we don't do that. And that really developing, becoming strong people is actually one of the benefits of developing in practice. Becoming a strong person that develops a strong inner core or capacity of various kinds. And it's important because certainly we wanted to have enough strength to not succumb to our defilements, not succumb to greed, hate, and delusion, not succumb to unwholesome, unhealthy fear. And one of the things that people can be afraid of is they can be afraid of themselves. And so certainly be afraid of things out in the world, but they can be afraid of themselves, afraid of what they're going to say, what they're going to do, what they're going to think, and what they're going to feel. And so there's a kind of an avoidance of really connecting here because of this self-fear that can exist. Now, that self-fear then also, what it does, it can easily dampen personal strength. And in fact, some people are afraid of their strength. They're afraid that if they are strong, that they will harm someone, that they will cause trouble for other people, other people will be uncomfortable, that somehow they'll be seen as conceited or seen as being somehow assertive too much in a way that's maybe considered unacceptable in the scenes, the situation we're in. And then also sometimes this fear of one's own strength can be related to a fear, an idea that we don't really have a full right to exist, or we're not really worthy enough to be strong, that somehow we're diminished, we're less than others, or we should really, we should really kind of keep small, stay small, or stay unnoticed, or stay in the back row, or somehow diminish ourselves, because to not diminish ourselves sometimes is socially disruptive for the scene that we're in. And sometimes in some families and even some cultures, that there's a preference for somehow not being a little bit self-effacing, a little bit not assertive. And certainly that can be quite valuable and at times quite healthy and appropriate. But it can lend itself or support go along with a tendency for people to be afraid of their own strength or reluctant to embody it or engage it or not to realize or appreciate that it can be developed and grow. Some people are kind of looking for something that's going to fix them, some insight, some inner experience, something that's going to be their savior from the difficulties they have. And so they're kind of a little bit looking outside of themselves for a solution. And one of the things about strength, as strength in practice develops, there's something that grows from the inside out that is a little bit has the effect of not solving problems, not providing an answer per se, but we grow in such a way that, like the snake that grows, the skin gets shed, the old skin gets shed. And there's something about cultivating and developing a strong inner strength or sense of power, or powers or strengths, maybe in the plural, that makes us grow, and old things just get shed. They fall off us rather than needing to be solved. So to spend too much time trying to solve problems sometimes is a dead end. Solve our inner turmoils and challenges. Sometimes it's actually more useful to develop a strength. So, for example, a strength in mindfulness, a strength in concentration, a strength in ethics, integrity, a strength in patience, and strength in telling the truth and being truthful to oneself or maybe to others. As really a strength of presence, really to, and sometimes that can be done physically. In fact, so much of what can be developed in practice develops stronger, develops more effectively if there's a kind of embodied association or embodied connection to actually doing this, embodied mindfulness, embodied presence, embodied truth. So clearly, the Buddha wanted people to be strong. And Buddhist practice develops inner strength. And as I said, ideally we become stronger than our defilements, so we don't cause problems in the world or problems for ourselves. And some of the language the Buddha used in his teachings are words that I associate with strength, the words like ardency, but practice in an ardent way. To the word that's often translated as effort, which kind of, the word effort is a fine word, but it's kind of a neutral word, just effort. It doesn't carry any strength in it. And the word that's often translated as effort is virya. And virya probably more appropriately should be translated as something like courageous effort. That the word vira, that virya is part of, is a word for hero. I've been told that in modern India, it's the word for a soldier. And so heroic effort, I think, is sometimes the way it's translated in maybe in Tibetan Buddhism, where they use the word hero that in related terms. So the idea of courageous effort. And then also the word power itself that is used. And as people develop in freedom in Buddhism, greater freedom, including a freedom from conceit, they are frequently depicted as becoming powerful. Language and symbolism of mature practitioners is often represented by images of power. So, for example, there's a delightful sutta where someone who develops to some degree of freedom, initial degree of freedom, together with the seven powers of awakening, seven factors of awakening, is described as having a great self, a large self. And it's a little bit surprising to hear this language of self used in such a definitive way, a great self, a large self. And that great self and large self is represented, or is the analogy for it, is a kind of a great mythic being that develops, that grows in the great Himalayan mountains. It's kind of a river spirit, a river serpent. And so it's called a naga, and in this case, naga means many things, but one of the things is these river spirit serpents. And that a person develops some initial taste of freedom, becomes one of these great nagas of who are of a great self and a large self, expansive self is one translation. One of the also delightful expressions of the power, the strength that a practitioner can have is in what's called the lion's roar. It was something that the people at the time of the Buddha did this and other people did it as well. They would declare their full awakening. When someone came and told the Buddha that they were fully awakened, that was referred to their lion's roar. And I don't know if you've ever been close to a lion that roared, but I have. Fortunately for me, at the zoo, maybe not fortunately for the lion, but I was probably standing 4 or 5 feet away from the lion, and with bars between us, and the roar that it directed in my direction was one that commanded a tremendous amount of respect. I had a primordial feeling that the whole bowels of the earth were kind of roaring at me, and I thought the only proper thing to do with that roar was to walk away. So the lion's roar, not that we're supposed to walk away from enlightened people, but it's a expression that conveys great confidence and great strength. So one of the things that are called powers in Buddhism, and here we see that the powers are not meant to be powers that we on other people, but rather inner capacities that we have. The five powers are the five faculties when they're strong. And these are faith or confidence, to have the power of confidence, of faith, the power of this courageous effort, that the courageous effort has now become something, a real strength that we carry with us. Power of mindfulness, the power of samadhi, usually translated as concentration, and the power of wisdom. What a great power to have, wisdom, to be wise in a way that it's a real strength that we carry with us. Another place where I associate with power is what's called the four resolves, and the Pali word is adhitana, which is means could almost more literally be translated in English as taking a stand, the etymology of the word, but usually as resolves. And so what we have resolve for is what there's a power, there's a strength behind us in doing it. And so these are also interesting lists. Again, it's not power over others. So it's the first one, resolve, is not neglecting wisdom. The second one preserving, protecting the truth. The third is cultivating the capacity to let go, to relinquish. And the fourth is to train in peace, train peacefully, train to become more peaceful, to develop a strength of being peaceful. Sometimes we don't associate, I think, power and peacefulness together. It's almost like peacefulness is an alternative to being powerful, but the power, the resolve of being peaceful. So living in a confident, committed, and dignified fashion are some of the associations with this developing this power, this capacity to be. And so there's not a self, it doesn't look from the outside like some a developed practitioner is self-effacing, at least not in how they carry and hold themselves. But it is in terms of not having any conceit or arrogance, letting go of being self-centered at the same time as being strongly centered. no egotistical center, but a strong centered in our lived, vital experience of being here and present. One of the ways we might understand this is to live in a manner where there's no need to apologize for ourselves. I think there's a strong tendency in the United States for some people to constantly want to say they're sorry, to apologize, to kind of diminish themselves for exerting themselves or being, even being. And I think that to live in a way that we don't have to apologize, not regularly, of course, not regularly, not as a policy, not as a second nature thing to always feel sorry or apologize. And the way to do that in Buddhism is to live what the Buddha called a blameless life. A blamelessness that is meant to bring a certain kind of joy, the strength of a blameless life. And this is to live a life that adheres to the precepts, to not harm people, not intentionally be involved in causing hurt or harm through killing and stealing and sexual misconduct and lying and using intoxicants. And to really have confidence that one is living this way, we end up living a life we don't have to apologize for ourselves, to be blameless. And I don't think it's second nature for many of the people here in this country, but if you can live that way, then you're encouraged to feel the joy of that, the joy and the power of a blameless life, an unapologetic life. In the Dhammapada, there's wonderful descriptions of strong people that they don't use the word strong, but I think we can substitute it reasonably enough. And there's a whole chapter called the Brahmin. The Brahmins were kind of the priests of the Brahmanical religion. They're also a hereditary role, so there were families that were Brahmanical families. And they thought of themselves as being the top class in society and the dominant class. And often they were, had a lot of authority sometimes and owned a lot of land, had a lot of wealth. And they were responsible for the religious rituals of the Brahmanical religion. And there was often a kind of, not just in Buddhism, but in other areas of India as well, a kind of jockeying for position or but who was it really should be dominant, or a kind of critique of the dominance of the Brahmins. And the Buddha, he did this by redefining what it means to be a Brahmin. And he defined a Brahmin as someone who has some degree of spiritual awakening. And so here are some examples of these ways which he says this. This is a verse from the Dhammapada. Who has no clinging, who has nothing, I call a Brahmin. So at first, no clinging, having nothing, that doesn't really seem like a situation of power or strength or, you know, an important class of people in society or someone to revere or something. Who has no clinging, who has nothing, I call a Brahmin. Whoever is most excellent, a bull, a hero, a great sage, a conqueror, free of craving, cleansed, awakened, I call a Brahmin. So here now, that's all. These are all synonyms for the same person, all kind of describing the same kind of person. Here they're talking about excellence, a bull, which is a powerful animal, a hero, which has strength to it, and a conqueror. Now, this can be quite off-putting for many people in the West to have these kind of masculine-seeming words or concepts associated with it. But they're clearly associated with non-clinging, freedom from craving, inner cleanliness. It's not an assertiveness or a dominance. The idea of conquering, being a conqueror, is really becoming conqueror of one's own defilements, one's own inner attachments and clinging. One conquers oneself, in a sense, not others. So we get this clear example in other verses in Dhammapada that this power, strength of a practitioner is not meant to be over other people, but it's really over themselves. In these verses, having given up violence towards beings both timid and strong, whoever neither kills or causes others to kill, I call a Brahmin. I say, is strong. Whoever is not adversarial among those who are, peaceful among those who are violent, not clinging among those who cling, I call a Brahmin. Whoever lets passion, hostility, conceit, and hypocrisy fall away like a mustard seed from the tip of an awl, I call a Brahmin, who speaks what is true, informative, and not harsh, who gives offense to no one, I call a Brahmin. So for me, in these verses, all this emphasis on non-harming is presented in a way that represents a real strength of people. There's a dedication, a commitment. This definitively, this is what a person is. This idea of a blameless life that doesn't cause harm in any kind of way. To do that with strength and be able to stand up in a dignified, confident way, to carry oneself in the world with confidence. To know oneself well enough, to know all the forces of fear, self-belittlement, self-fear, the ways that we self-criticize ourselves and kind of become less than who we are, and to learn to shed those, to learn to not have them diminish us, so that our native strength, it's not assertive strength, it's not like puffing ourselves up in some arrogant macho way, but rather the native strength of who we are can be there in a simple, natural, full way. It's not, we don't diminish it, we don't apologize for it, we don't, you know, hide it or hide from it, that somehow we're allowed to be strong, we're allowed to be present, fully embodied and here in a clear, definitive way. We are worthy of that. In fact, one of the meaning for arhat, someone who's fully awakened, literally means a worthy one. And I kind of like to translate, to interpret that mean the worthy of really being present, being here and alive and full. So that one of the goals of Buddhist practice is to become fearless. And part of that is to stop undermining ourselves through fear. And the fear that I wanted to emphasize today in this chat is self-fear. How we are afraid of ourselves and therefore diminish ourselves and kind of undermine our strength. So to do this, it helps to take stock of our fear of how we're afraid of ourselves, including our fear of being strong. This then allows us to address these fears and develop growing confidence in our capacity to live intentionally without harming anyone, including ourselves. So I hope that these ideas that I've presented here are meaningful enough for you to reflect and consider a little bit how it is that what appropriate way can you step up and allow for yourself to have a native power, native strength of someone who metaphorically stands their ground, speaks freely and confidently what they feel like they have to say, can talk honestly, doesn't diminish themselves, but just is there, allowed to be present and fully there and have a voice and show up. And that is, I think, one of the great benefits from doing mindfulness practice. The mindfulness practice that helps us to let go of any force within us that diminishes us, that undermines our native natural strength that's here. And in doing so, we might end up looking like strong people in the eyes of others. But in our own inner sense, we won't necessarily feel that we are now strong. The inner sense is feeling now we're free. But to be free from the outside will look as if we've become strong. So I hope that you will think about this and reflect on it. And hopefully there's something of what I said today that will be useful for you. And I would love to meet each of you in your strength. So thank you all very much.